the source of every evil is spiritual. It doesn't matter what it is. And its source, its real source, is, so to say, at the footstool of the throne of Hashem. And it is only when it comes down to earth, which we call the Olam Asiyo, the place of action and of deed, it is only there that it is translated and transformed into the form in which we find it. And that is very difficult to understand. So we call that Ishtarshus. There is a kind of chain effect from its very source until it in its present form that we have it, with which we are able to operate with it here upon earth. A nation also has its source, and its source is spiritual. A nation has its source, and the source of that nation is called the son of that nation. The word son means prince, but really it is a power. And there is a certain power that that nation has, and it influences that particular nation. And here we have a case where there was a struggle that went on between Yaakov and Esau. It was a struggle that started in the womb, that continued as they were leaving the womb, where Yaakov was holding on to the heel of Esau. It went through their abuse to the extent that Yaakov exacted from Esau the sale of his birthright. It went on afterwards when Yaakov took the blessing and not Esau, and it continued afterwards when Esau was after his brother wanted to destroy him. And that battle between Esau and Yaakov has never ceased. And the hatred of Esau towards Yaakov has never ceased. And here it was an attempt on the part of the power of Esau, the Sarshel Esau, to undo Yaakov. And the struggle was to weaken him and let him lose his strength. Now, the strength of Yaakov and of Israel, their strength is the Torah. And the struggle was to weaken that strength. That is what this story represents. But what I want you to know is that little piece, that every nation has got its own self, its copy is a power and an influence, and that influence influences the nation. And so we find that each nation has got its own language, and not only has each nation got its own language, each province has got its own pronunciation, and those are the influences. Each country and each nation has got its own culture, and the culture can be very strong, and the culture comes from the south. It is a spiritual force that governs it and controls it to some extent. Now, once I've dealt with that, we are ready to begin our share today. And share today events in Israel, our understanding and response. Now, what is happening in Israel is something that disturbs each one of us, and what is happening is really, to some extent, beyond our understanding. But I would like to understand it in terms of Torah and in terms of Chazal. And first of all, we must know that the Chazal speak about Ikkas of the Mashiach. And Ikkas of the Mashiach, says Rashi, it is when the end of the exile, the Golus, is drawing near. And it is before the coming of Moshiach. That is Ikkas of the Mashiach. Literally, it means that one can already hear the footsteps of Moshiach. And we are told by Chazal that this will be a very difficult period. Now, you might ask, why do we believe that we are now passing in that particular time. And this has been accepted by our great authorities of the last 50 years or so, that they were saying that we're coming to that time, and then they said that we are already in that period. And the test is a very simple one, because the Gemara tells us what is going to happen in Ikkar Sagadashim. And I remember when I learned it the very first time, to me it seemed so strange and it seemed so impossible that I just glossed over it. And I'm almost ashamed to admit to myself today that I didn't take it seriously. For example, it said that the method of negotiation would not be communication, but would be chutzpah, would be terrorism. That is the way people would negotiate something. It says that a mother will be afraid of her daughter-in-law, that a father will be afraid of his son. His son will tell him what to do. He won't be able to control his children at all. It tells us that the government will be an atheistic government. Now, it's not speaking about the American government, and it's not speaking about the English government. It's speaking about our government. The those in power will not believe in God. And it doesn't mean only Eretz Israel. It means that the leadership of the people of Israel will be in the hands of those who don't believe in God. Now, in my day, it was very difficult to believe anything like that. And one sees it's all coming true. It says there won't be a shortage of it, but there won't be the money to buy it, because things will be so exorbitant. And it seemed all so strange. And everything that it says is exactly as it says it's coming to pass. What I thought is something quite impossible, yet it is, we are right in the middle of it all. And in all that it tells us, that the MS Nehemiahs, truth will disappear. There won't be truth. There are two Peshavis for the MS Nehemiahs. The one Peshav is, as I've tried to translate it, the truth will disappear. Now, I saw it coming many years ago. But even when I saw it coming, I could never believe that it would come to what it has come now. It has taken place, revisionism, and now history is being rewritten. And how is it being rewritten? One of the things are, the Holocaust didn't take place, and this is now being written. Other things are being written, that the times were always as they are now. Now it's better, there's more morality now than there ever was before. It's not true that there has been a decrease in the standard of morality. And all this is being rewritten now. I saw a documentary on the screen of Montgomery. Now this is a period that I lived through, and I've got some intimate connection with it. And it starts off, the story is exactly as it happened. But gradually, and you can see the tendentiousness of it all, and you can see what the purpose is going to be. Gradually, the importance of Montgomery is minimized. Then it becomes such, he becomes a man that he's somewhat of a character of a man. In the end, he ends up as a very small person. He's an entity by the time the film has finished. And this is a revisionism that is taking place. And here we find an expression of the Ho'emes Ne'emes, and the truth is disappearing. According to others, the meaning of Ho'emes Ne'emes is not that the truth is disappearing, but it comes from the word aver, a flock. And truth is now being found in groups, each one claiming that it has the group, that group has the truth, and no one else has the truth. So that is where it has come to at the moment. I want to concentrate this afternoon on that particular aspect of Ikvasa de Mashiach. Now, when it comes to the question of truth, we find that the question of truth is mentioned in Chazal very early. It goes back to before the creation. And the Midrash puts it in the following words. Beshor Shavua Kodesh Baruch Hu Dibros Esor Lemorisho Nasu Malachei Asorim Shoreis Kiki Kiki Mechabudas Kabunas. When Hashem was about to create man, he consulted with the ministering angels, with these forces and powers that he had created before, and they found themselves on two sides. The one side said man should be created, and the other side said man should not be created. So we find one power, and you must understand it in the context of those verses in the Torah which I read to you and I explained to you before I began this year. So one has Chesed said, when it came to a question of consideration, Chesed spoke up and said that man should be created because he is a Gomer Chesed. He will be a person who will show consideration to others and show kindness to others. Truth said he mustn't be created. Emes said he mustn't be created because after all he's Kudosh Hakodesh. Man will be completely self-impulsive. Tzedek said he should be created because he will do tzedakah, he will be charitable. Shalom, peace said, on no account is he to be created. The Kulek Toto, because it will be all dissension, it will be all quarreling, don't create. So on the one hand we've got Chesed and Tzedek that say he should be created, and Emes and Sholem will say he shouldn't be created. Now why they fall into two categories is quite simple, because when one comes to Chesed, when one comes to Emes and Sholem, he mustn't be created because there won't be truth and there will be quarreling. When it comes to Emes and Sholem, it's got to be complete. You can't be a little bit truthful. It's got to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. When it comes to peace, you can't arrange, all right, we'll have peace on Mondays and Thursdays, but on Sundays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we're going to fight. You can't have a situation like that. It's either peace or it's not peace. Whereas Chesed and Tzedek can be peaceful. A person can do a little bit of Chesed and it's Chesed. Another person can do more Chesed and it's Chesed. A little person can give a little tzedakah, but it is tzedakah. But when it comes to Emes Sholem, it must be there in its entirety. And therefore, those two factions say, on no account is man to be created. Now comes a very strange part in the Midrash. What did Hashem do? He took Emes and he tossed it down to the earth. And then Emes may air its titzma. And the truth will grow out of the earth. It's an interesting situation. And what it means is that Hashem takes a Dar'in. He takes a grain, a seed of Emes, and he casts it down to the earth. And the earth must mold that seed into truth. It must nurture it, and it must be molded into truth. And so, on the human level, what does it mean? That in every human being there is planted a seed of truth, something of truth in a human being. And the human being must take that truth and he must, so to say, develop it into something that stands on his own. Now I want to give you an example of it, of how it works. We time that God created man, and God created the world in which there shouldn't be anything for nothing. God gives man, but it's not for nothing. English, by the Esther in the first Brocha, we say God is not an Osef Chesed, he's not one who does Chesed, but he's a Del Meor Chesed. Now, Del Meor Chesed means, Gemilus Chesed means that it's reciprocal. If it's not reciprocal, it's Osef Chesed. Hashem is not an Osef Chesed. He doesn't do Chesed, and one hasn't got to do anything in return. The chesed that Hashem does is for what we do here upon earth. And when we've got the chesed of Hashem, we say that man was created in such a way that even for his own perfection, as much of it as he's able to achieve, he's got to work and he's got to struggle for it. And that is why evil was created. That he's got this continuous struggle, and as he struggles against evil, then his reward is his own perfection. But to be born perfect, Hashem didn't create us perfect, because that would have been the greatest imperfection of all. The imperfection of getting something for nothing. So each man has got to work for it, and that is the kudus ha'emes. That is the truth in every human being. Don't want anything for nothing. Now, we find that there is a very strange phenomenon, and one can't help noticing it when one deals with human beings. If one deals with human beings to a tremendous extent, one finds that they fall into two categories. One helps the person. That helps the person to such an extent one puts him on the street. One helps him to get married, have children, to be somebody. And then, he becomes very appreciative and remains so. And there is a love towards his benefactor. All the exact reverse happens. After he's received so much, he turns against his benefactor, but with such hatred and with such venom. What is the reason? If one studies it very carefully, you will find that the venom and the hatred is greatness towards the benefactor, where the benefactor has taken nothing in return for it. Hasn't taken a fee. He's done it all for nothing. There it is greatest. Because deep, deep down in the human being, there is this truth. And the truth is, if I get anything for nothing, it's not mine. And it's a bad situation. It's a low person who does that. And this person has given it to me. I hate him for it. This is the truth within me. That the kudus ha'emes, that little bit of truth that rebels against that person. Now, where you've got the truth, you can do one or the other with it. You can nurture the truth into something that's very great, and there can be nothing but great love for one's benefactor. Or it can deal with all, it gets almost rooted out. Man doesn't know how to deal with it, doesn't want to know how to deal with it. And that is the way he reacts towards his benefactor. So the truth is there, now part of the truth, and you see, in here on earth, the truth is able to grow. Depends upon the human being, what he does with it. So now we see that truth was the one who won. Truth, God created man, and God created that the goodness of heavens. There is that little truth that is in that. Now, one can suppress it completely, or it can grow. So what we have seen, both things have been happening. And we've got the situation today where for Emes Neogenes, the truth has ceased to exist. Very difficult for there to be truth. Man has not nurtured it. And on the other hand, it's been Naasis Neogenes Neogenes. You've got groups of people, and each one claims the truth. In Israel, you've got it in the political parties. You've got it in the different expressions of what I call Judaism. And of course, what we are concerned about is that there is no upstairs, that there is no unity. Indeed, there is a hatred between these different groups. And that is what we are examining. Now, they have been groups of Jews throughout the ages. If we will take the period before the outbreak of World War II, it's a period with which we are acquainted. You have different kinds of Jews, and I'm just keeping the map in my mind's eye, starting from Latvia. It was totally in Latvia. The Jewish cop was in Latvia, in place. It was still there. Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Russia, Galicia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, all those Jews were different. What was the difference of those Jews? How did they come to be different? We go back to my introduction. Every nation has got its side. And you can see it in the different nations. I used to wonder when I was in Eastern Europe, the difference that I used to see between a Lithuanian and a Russian. A Lithuanian, when he got drunk, he rode into the gutter and he remained there until he became sober. When a Russian got drunk, he danced and he drank more than he ate and he said. That is what he did when he was drunk. The Russian was a very warm person. The Lithuanian was a cold person, very calculated. Those were differences that I was able to see. Now, you have these different groups of Jews. And I'm not speaking about Jews who didn't teach. I'm speaking about Jews who were not only learned in Torah, but Jews who were steeped in Torah. And each one of these places had their own derech, had their own way of Torah. There was the Lithuanian derech, and there was the Galician derech, and there was the Hungarian derech. It was quite different, but there was never any quarreling against the human groups. Now, you might say that it was because they were, geographically, they were divided, and they didn't have to quarrel. But it wasn't so. Because when they came together, there was tremendous love. And sometimes they did come together. There was Rebbeim Levi. Rebbeim Levi must have died in about 1929 or 1930. He died a very young man. He was of the Galician school. But we honor that the Lithuanian school paid Rebbeim Levi. The honor that the Hungarian school paid to that man would be. He was a giant in Torah, and it was recognized by all. He was the innovator of the Daf HaYomi, and the whole world accepted it, and this was before the war. The whole world accepted it. No question about a person like that. And when we go back to 100 years earlier, the Rabbi Akiva Eger married the daughter of the Chassam Sefer. Rabbi Akiva Eger was the exponent of Lithuanian terror. The Hassan Center was the experiment of Hungarian terror. The tie that existed between the two, when Rabbi Akiva Eger came to Hungary, the Jews of Pressburg came out miles outside the town with a carriage. They came with carriages to meet Rabbi Akiva Eger, who was coming to Pressburg. And some center himself was in one carriage, a leading carriage, going out to meet Rabbi Akiva Eger. When they came, when the two met, Rabbi Akiva Eger got out of his carriage and got into the Chassam Sente's carriage. The people in Hungary were so overcome that they had these two great ones there that they decided it wasn't right that horses should draw their carriage. They took out the horses and they themselves pulled the carriage. When they came to Pressburg, the carriage was empty. And they found that the Rabbi Akiva Eger and some center were walking deep in learning, discussing, being oblivious to everything that had been taking place. And they went to them, what had happened? But some center saw that they human beings were pulling the carriage. He said, "This is for Rabbi Akiva Eger, not for me. I am an interloper, I prefer life to hear that he got out." Rabbi Akiva Eger said, "That must be for the Chassam Center that they do it. Can't be for me, so he got out the other side." So the carriage remained empty. But the respect that they had for one another, no question about it. Occasionally, young men from Hungary would come and study in the Lithuanian yeshivas. And there was a reason why they centered there. They felt that the Taylor was so pure they wanted them to get some training in it. But they sent them there. There was no thought that they would keep them separately. After the war in Israel, all this has gone. Now, of course, the Jew is influenced by the country in which he lives. And so you find that in Lithuania, the Jew is very analytical in his study, in his understanding of the Torah. In Poland, slightly different. In Galicia, they are far more concerned with the length and the breadth of the Torah than they are concerned with the depth of the Torah. It's a different type of learning. In Hungary, there is a different type of learning. The Jews of all these places are different. The way they act in their prayers, in their synagogues, is different. And you take the Germans, the German is very particular. Everything must be exactly as it's been handed down. And so in Germany, they were very particular about that. But I want you to know that in spite of all this, there was an awareness that this was happening, and everything was done to preserve the purity of the Torah. And what kept the people together, and it was one huge society, what kept them together was the bond of the Torah, and that I will explain to you now. And I want you to know that every couple of years, there used to be a conference, and it used to be mostly in Marienbad, in Czechoslovakia, and these were the Gedolei Yisrael from Hungary, from Czechoslovakia, from Galicia, from Poland, from Lithuania. They all came together in Marienbad and spent several weeks together. And this was considered to be a very great event. But the censure that they had, differences, yes. And so we find that there was no uniformity. But there was certainly a unity in diversity. What is it that kept them all together? We Jews, as with everyone else and as with everything else, created for ourselves a framework. And that framework goes to the table. And in this framework we can move very easily. But as long as we kept within this framework, and so it didn't matter whether you were belonged to the Hungarian school or the Galician school, whether you belonged to the Polish school or to the Lithuanian school, it didn't matter, because it was all within this ideas, it was all within this place. And then something happened. And here I must introduce something to you in brevity. We've got a concept in Torah which is Tumor. Tumor is a spiritual impurity. Now, there are several types of tumor, and hopefully I will be able to deal only with one type of tumor. The greatest tumor that existed in one particular place in the old days was in Egypt. And Paro was called Paro from the word Pei Rai Leish Ein, for Ra, which means to uncover, to break down and to uncover. And tumor is when one breaks down these boundaries that form the framework. And now there is no boundary there. And so if you have permissiveness, there you have tumor. There is nothing to deter anyone from doing anything. All the boundaries are broken down. Once the boundaries are broken down, there is tumor. And so we've got things like guilt. A person feels guilt. Very important for this framework. A person has got a sense of busha, a sense of shame. Very important for the stranger. If you break down any sense of guilt, if you break down any sense of shame, person needn't be ashamed, nothing to be ashamed of. That is tumor. That is the greatest form of tumor. What has happened today in Israel and elsewhere is that we have broken down those boundaries which form the framework of the Torah, and we have created another framework for ourselves. In Israel, what makes it so difficult is that all these different schools and all these different people, and now we're not speaking about those ones who are steeped in learning, but we are speaking about the followers. They are all put together in a tiny area. And they've got their own ways. They've been influenced, each has been influenced by the son of his nation. And influenced the Jews. But whereas before, the framework in which the Jew worked, doesn't matter where he lived, the Torah was the same. There was no difference in that. The language was Loshon HaKodesh. It was the same wherever he was. That was the bond that kept the Jews together. When it came to Israel, that was broken down. It's the tumor that came into existence in our own day. The breaking down of any kind of faith. But the Jew has to be placed. And it's been replaced in Israel by politics. And so, that is the guiding principle. It's politics that decides. And you've got all these different people forming different groups, and they are in this place. The question is, what is our response to this understanding? I want you to know that although I've painted a dismal picture of what life is like in Israel today, And it's the same elsewhere. The only thing is that people have got more room to move about and to express themselves. In Israel it's a very tight community, that in spite of the dismal picture that I've painted to you, there is another picture also. And that is that you still find individuals who live completely within the framework of the Torah. You still find communities that live completely within the framework of the Torah. You will still find yeshivas, although there are very few, that live completely and that function completely in a framework of Torah and not in a framework. Just to give you an illustration, in the great yeshivas before the outbreak of World War II, and in the Lithuanian school, which was the world school alone, there were 10 schools, and each school had developed its own way, and each school had developed its own merit, but it was all within the world school. And the idea of the world school was to have Torah in all its purity, that it shouldn't be influenced by anything outside. 10 schools all lived very comfortably with one another. So some of these schools became very large, and you had several people at the head of the institution. There was the best of relationships between the heads of the institutions, of one institution. You couldn't wish for a better relationship. Not only was there a good relationship between the heads, but between the institutions themselves. We had a case, two of my best friends in Telz. One was the son of Rebbe Avraham Brodzinski, the Rosh Yeshiva of Sabotka. The other was the son of the Provisional. Our Rosh Yeshiva sent their children to Sabotka and to Mir. And there was this interchange. That is how it was, because the Misgiris, the framework in which one worked, was the Torah. There was no other framework. Today, it is known that there is considerable bickering going on between the heads of the institutions themselves. And then the students start taking sides. And it's a very unhealthy situation. All part of this, the framework has now become politics. On the other hand, we still have yeshivas where they live completely in the mysterious culture. We find communities, very, very few, but we find. We find individuals who are completely in the mysterious culture. That is the only consideration. And it's easy, because we've all got it written down. If it's a question of an interpretation of a point, we know who to ask, and we can deal with it. What is our response to a situation such as this? Now, I've mentioned it to you before, my uncle used to speak to us about it. And afterwards I realized why he used to speak to us about it. Because he was quite sure that we would live through these times and that we would have to have it. And he said, don't fight. Don't fight it. And I understand now why he said don't fight it. Because once you fight it, you're in the same thing again. You're in the politics. Where the Misgiris, the framework, is the politics. And he said, look after yourself and after yourself only. He said, if you are responsible for anybody, look after the person for whom you are responsible. Look after the people for whom you are responsible. Don't go outside of that, and you will be able to. Once one goes outside into that, one is pulled into the politics of it. And that is our response. And what is taking place in Israel, it will have nothing to do with it. And what we've learned about themselves there, as far as our people are concerned, those who work within the framework of the Torah will continue to work within the framework of the Torah. It is a force which one cannot fight against. And my uncle is quoted as having said there and left it at that. But he didn't. He added a corollary to it. And the corollary was, and that is the greatest contribution that you can make, by your example and by the effort in attending yourself as those for whom you are responsible, and not going beyond that. I know that there is some confusion about all that is taking place. For what it is worth, that is my personal philosophy, based on what I was taught. For what it is worth, I am talking to you. Thank you very much. And so man is really, in that sense, his own creator. And so it is with society also. There are these forces. These forces against Torah are greatest within Torah itself. The force of Torah is greatest in the Torah itself. And the Torah's got to struggle against it. It collapsed, it wasn't able to see it through. You understand what I'm saying? That is the challenge. There's always that challenge. It failed to respond to that challenge. Your second question is,
as a matter of history and not looking at the current situation.
Yes, sir. Yes, I remember now. If you want to know what was the relationship between the Hasidim, there was one very great battle between Mizrahim and Hasidim that was against a particular sect of Hasidim. And Vindergold fought that battle, and he fought it on one basis only, and that is that in the Torah world there is the supremacy of the Torah, and everything else must be subsidiary to it. Whatever there is subsidiary to the Torah, and that is something which the Gold School has remained true always. That the reality is the Torah. That is the reality. Everything is subsidiary. There was great direct evidence towards the Hasidim from the Mizrahim, and from the Mizrahim towards the Hasidim. For example, the Tzanzer Hasidim, there was the Divrei Chaim, the Chaim Tzanzer. The Chaim Tzanzer was great. We use his words continuously. We work with it continuously. No question about that. The Torah of Hasidim received the greatest respect. My uncle went, must have been nearly 100 years ago. Pat Emes died in 1904, and my uncle was in his home. And I heard from my uncle that it was embarrassing. My uncle was a young man. It was embarrassing to my uncle the way that he was the Spas Emes, the Golden River, treated him. It was embarrassing to him. And he knew who the Golden River was. It was the greatest respect. There was only, there was a difference in that was in any group of Hasid or any sect put anything else above Torah, if they did prayer above Torah, if they did chesed above Torah, anything above Torah, that was for it. There must be the supremacy of the Torah. That is the reality. Everything must relate to the Torah and be judged in terms of Torah. Yes, Dr. Kerr.
Would it fall from the paradigm that you laid out that the religious parties that exist today, like Shas and Lego and whatever, should fundamentally be eradicated. And in effect, they should stick with Torah and let the impact of Torah go not through politics, but just as you described, behavior.
That is my personal opinion. And I always qualify it or modify it by the words for what it is worth. That is my personal philosophy. Only contaminants. That is true. Break down the root. Break down that is given of terror. For the Jew, that is true. Sometimes one or two questions. Yes?
We've talked about this before. At what point do you stand up and fight? How do you know that the difference is now becoming a breakdown in Torah rather than some minor influence of the local community? You've got big differences in the United States between four different groups of the Orthodox. I remember I had a discussion with you at one time about the insistence and if uniformity is, at what point is it clear that uniformity is no longer Torah but it's moving in the wrong direction? And now you've given in all the way. And now you don't have any outside influence that is pure.
Yes, you see, you've got the Hitzelius. The Hitzelius is the outside trappings of it. And the outside trappings, you've got to be careful not to confuse it with Torah. So, I've explained this to you quite often, that in the great Yeshivas, nobody wore a black suit. It is considered to be improper to wear a black suit and a black hat. It's considered improper. The Rosh Yeshiva, yes, they wore black suits and black hats. They wore long coats. Because if there was an accord between their behavior, their knowledge, their piety, and the way they were dressed. We felt it would be improper. Unmarried, thoughts not always of the cleanest. Never did a thing like that. Even those who wore long coats, very, very careful. Very, very careful before they wore a long coat. The great Reb Meir didn't wear a long coat. The great Reb Mordechai Romanski didn't wear a long coat. I've got a picture in my desk, it only got into my desk after you left, but not because of that. I've got a picture in my desk of the Mordechai Romanski. Somebody in Cleveland sent it to me, got the picture and knew that I wanted to see a picture from Mordechai Romanski. Mordechai Romanski is wearing a yarmulke. Today, when you come to your wedding, you're supposed to sit in your hat, you mustn't put on a yarmulke. Nobody's taken a photograph of him with a yarmulke on. These are the outside trappings. When you're living in that society, you do as they do. You can't help it. But I know any number of young men. I'm thinking of one in particular. I was at a Greece recently, and he was given an honor. He couldn't read the words. He had a given honor with the manual. He couldn't read the words. There's a long coat and a black hat. And the people look at him and look at me and say, that is a rabbi. So what have we come to? What have we come to? The outside traffic has been a tremendous amount of that. I see no problem there. There are problems in the news. Other things there are problems. All right. Then mentioned this very often. Wherever Gramsci once said to me, there was something I wanted to do, he said, don't do it. And I said, is it wrong? He said, no, it's absolutely right. He said, why not do it? He said, they'll annihilate you. Can't do that. Okay? You just go along as you come along. The rabbi, if you walk with him, I had a telephonic relationship that phoned me a little while ago. He had heard that I was at the very big city. Explain to him, it was the big city with the servant, husband, wife, wife, husband, and so forth. So he said, yes, you shouldn't be at a place like that. I said, I just don't understand. I said, you never have this in your life. He said, that's impossible. I said, well, I'll tell you, this is a position. I know. Anyway, he left me there. 2 days later, he both said, he said, I've got to apologize to you. You were right. I've done it because I've done it to Adrian. He said, but I want to tell you something. When the Aaron Kotler's son got married, that is, the date of Aaron Kotler, the Shneur got married, and his son was his successor, he said, Nick City, you're quite right. I said, there you are. He said, oh, just a moment. But when the Schneider's son got married, Malki Ayo, there wasn't mixing. So there you are. That's right. If that is the way, you have to accept it. You have to accept it. But does that make any difference to Torah? Does it mean to say we're not even inherited the Torah? We don't share the Torah. When the mayor would leave, came to Frankfurt am Main, he was invited to the Jakob Rosenheim's home. Jakob Rosenheim, he was a agent of a great labor. He came to the Jakob Rosenheim's and on a Friday night, sat down to a meal. And after finish was made and the meal had started, he said, I have something to say. And Jakob Rosenheim said, certainly, you want to hear the story. He said, it's not Taylor, it's the announcement. He said, what is the announcement? He said, where I live in between, we don't behave like this. Men sit in one room on a Friday night and the women in another room. And if it's in the same room, there's a machitza down the middle. Men on the one side, women on the other. But I'm in your company and I do as you do. Now he did that in order to cover himself. Because he knew that he would get back to Lublin, that this is the way he behaved, and he would be in great trouble. So he explained himself on the spot. The Torah is different. Did he have any less respect for the Jakob Rosenheim? Did the Jakob Rosenheim have any less respect for him? Nothing. But when it came to politics, this is the way we do it. And this is our Rebbe, we support him. But if he doesn't tell the line, then he's out.
There is a real difficulty. In Israel, as in other places, there's a tremendous influence on the body. That the body politic is what controls the laws of the land. And even the mores of the land, such that it controls marriage laws and kashrut laws and every other kind of law. And so the difficulty with all of this is, how do you work it so that there's some compatibility between the body politic and the spiritual requirements?
The way it was worked was always that there was a law within a law. There was a kingdom within a law. In Eastern Jewry, in Europe, the Jews were an entity on their own. But even here it exists. We've got our own marriage laws. We've got our own laws of divorce. And we are within, we won't do anything that is against the law of the country. But we will work within the framework of the Torah, even here. So it doesn't really present a problem. But we've got that framework, we work in it, so we work, it's a community within a community, a society within a society.
Okay, but it doesn't seem to work in Israel.
It does, because in Israel too, when it comes to laws of marriage, laws of divorce, laws of inheritance, it's in the religious courts. Just one moment, that's a good idea. It's in the religious courts. And that is recognized by the state.
But the only way they can maintain that kind of influence is through politics. That's the dilemma.
Is it? Yeah, they maintain it without any politics.
Because, by definition, there's a separation of religion and state.
In England, there's no separation of religion and state, but it maintains no religion.
Because, basically, the Jewish religion is just as you state, it's a separate entity within an entity. But in Israel, you don't have that.
But it has. Well, it's coming to it. Now, if Audrey Evan gets his way, and I can't believe he ever will, his way is break down all barriers. He says break down the national barriers. Let the Arabs take in the West Bank of these things and the start of Israel. Equal rights, they're exactly the same as Jews. That is his theory. And in 50 years' time, you've got no problem. No Jews, no Arabs, only Israelis. So what do you think that the total Jew would do? He would still have it. He'll still be able to function. They function like that in America, they function like that in England, they function like that in Israel. It was the Jews' wisdom. And only his wisdom that saw you can't have laws of marriage, divorce, you can't have that in the secular courts. If you have that in the secular courts, you're going to have Israelis and Jews. And he saw the danger. And that is great foresight. So he, and because it's a wonder, why should he have done that? He didn't want Shabbos, he wanted Sunday to be observed. He didn't want Shabbos, but this, there was no difficulty with this. This he realized he would split the Jews. But anyway, but it's worked. So, you can be outside of politics, and what you said is the argument of those who go into politics. They say, look, that is the argument.
Because it's the dilemma.
That is the argument. David, you want to ask the question, is everyone?
What concerns me is that in Israel, since they are, at least biologically, essentially Jews, so the tendency to infringe upon the religious Jewish sub-kingdom, as you describe, is far greater than it is in England or America, which it's quite easy for the going to say, let them have their kingdom. The arguments of the political religious Jew that Dr. Cohen is describing, does he not have a slightly stronger case in saying, we have to get into politics here, whereas we would not in England or America, because they want us. They want us here in their grip in a far more intense way than they would in England or America.
I don't agree with that. If it's necessary to fight, you fight. Mm-hmm. If they come into our territory, you fight. We watch our borders. We watch our framework. We watch our borders. We guard our borders zealously. We won't break it down from within. If from without there is an attempt to break it down, then we fight it. And we've got to fight it hard. And there's a wonderful description of that given obliquely in this book. Is it called The Soul of Fire? A fire in his soul. This is a remarkable book. Its value is in the history, where everything is documented, everything giving its sources given for everything. And this, for example, we cannot, under any circumstances, accept conservatism and reform. We cannot accept it under any circumstances. And there is a little story there, just one paragraph, that Amos Green has put into the book, and he's about a friend of mine. We studied together, and this is Aaron Paperman. And Aaron Paperman became the executive director of the Charity of Shiva the Free Press, and he collected tremendous sums of money. And got a tremendous sum of money, continues to be getting tremendous sums of money from a conservative Jew in Cleveland. And then this Jew died. And they made a very big service for him in the conservative. What do they call it? Temple. In the conservative temple. And after that was went to the burial ground. At the burial ground, the Aaron Paperman went up to the sun to condole with him and said to Aaron Paperman, he said, I've looked round about the temple for you and I couldn't see you anywhere. I want you to know that had you been in the temple, I would have lost all respect for you. And you wouldn't have got any money from me as the heir to my father's fortune. But now, I will carry on exactly as my father was carrying on. And I had occasion to speak about that. And I said, I'm not telling you this to tell you the greatness of Aaron Paperman. That is the very least I would have expected of Aaron Paperman. To me, it wasn't even a temptation. I want to tell you what your readers are there to speak. That was a conservative Jew. Once upon a time, you won't get it today. That is God. But the thing is to preserve that. We have got to preserve at all costs. And there is the whole account of how this has all been watered down, that conservative and reform is another expression of Judaism, and they've got to work together. It's all there, you've got it all clear. What the Baruch Kotler and about a dozen others, 10 others together with the Baruch Kotler, signed a declaration exactly laying out what is the situation. There you've got it very clear in that book. Just work by the thing. Thank you, ladies. Yeah.
That's why that simile can even be just as powerful as a simile. That's why it's amazing. How can they literally cut off ayahs from a film kid? How can they literally destroy a film kid? Because simile is star, it's pure. It's a pure simile. Based on a pure kin.
It's also, you know, sooner or more, you know, we spend a great deal of time in infusions. Like, after you're starting with a coma or a tour, I'm sure so that's all, it's Tzura hatred, which is on so much of a higher level than a Pushitkin out money, for example. If you have money and I don't know, I'm a candidate that you have a money or a bigger house. This is a kina on a superficial level. It's kina also. The other kina is on the highest possible spiritual level that one can possibly attain, is that kina. It's the religious versus non-religious, the belief in God versus non-religious.
Another benefit that accrues from betachon on Hashem for avodas Hashem he shabatech b'Hashem, somebody who relies on Hashem, in who bal hon, if he's a wealthy person, whom is garish the male beichushel, the chayfitz leib of the ruach nediva, es chavosov klapir lekim, es chavosov klapir neoda. If a person is wealthy, but he's betarach b'Hashem, he doesn't feel well. You know, the mitzvahs are all depleting my wealth because I got to buy a lulav, got to buy tefillin, got to make pesach. So look how much money I'm spending. My goyish and neighbor next door, all he has to do is buy Ferraris. And every time I want to do something, I got to take off new money, and 10% put stock, and new money. When it's terrible, it's never ending, right? No. He doesn't feel that, because he feels, since I've got to go, because I've got to allocate resources, He's allocated the resources that we need for the knowledge and understanding that these are my responsibilities. So I'm quite happy to use the apportioned wealth for those ends. We have Eid al-Rukhush, and if God forbid a person is poor, whom Shukhna, he can feel
He can become convinced
that in his particular case, not to have wealth, because Baruch has done him a favor. Why? Because he is freed by being poor. Because now he doesn't have the responsibilities the rich man has in the spiritual. That's not talking about the physical and concerns of a rich man. He's talking about that. He's talking about a rich man has to know when you come to Shemayim, they can ask you, Mr. A, I've got a question for you. Your bank account had $7 million. The other man you knew had $7,000 in his account. What do you think Hashem gave you $7 million and $7,000? You say, well, because I'm such a smart businessman, I took good opportunities, I was in the right place at the right time. Say, Shem Tishabayim, but I could Baruch distribute panacea to everybody. So there are plenty of people in the right place at the right time who don't have money, and then plenty of people in the wrong place at the wrong time who do have money. So what do you think you have money for? Don't you realize that you were given money in order to be distribute that money according to the Hilchas HaTorah, whatever the Hilchas HaTorah are, in order to be Zocher, to be a Shliach of Hashem, to do good things. So that's your responsibility. That's called in the Sharon Nisayon HaOsher. There's a Nisayon HaOni, to live through poverty, and there's a Nisayon HaOsher. One Nisayon HaOsher is, there's a lot of money, he can just float away and get so obsessed with his own covet and his own shudas, and he can float away. But there's another Nisayon HaOsher. You have to give away at least 10%, possibly 20% of a couple of $1 million a year. That takes doing. You have to set up an organization, you have to meet people, and you have to give the stockers, have to be satisfied, you give it the right way. If you just say, well, I gave $100,000 this year, but you made $5 million, so the $5 million maestro is $500,000. Where's the other $400,000? Well, I thought it was enough. But the Torah says it's not enough. Because Baruch Hu gave you more than demanding more. So the guy is a poor man, he hasn't got those problems. He makes $100, takes 10% stock, and that's the end of it, and everybody's done. Right? Don't have to have lines of people lining up his house, wanting to take money, etc., because they're not going to come to him, nothing to offer. But the rich man has a Nisayon. Klal Yisrael has requirements, and obviously the Baruch Hu distributed wealth to certain people to distribute it to others. There's no other explanation why you should have more money. Anyway, what? Because you're such a chochem. But then we go back to the old question. There's a question, who provides panosah? You or Hashem? See, Eilu Chacham, if you believe you provide, then you can answer, you're a chochem. But if you believe Hashem allocates, then there has to be a reason why it allocates to you, and that it's some responsibilities that come with it. So says, a person doesn't have can be the sigh of relief. Is there a responsibility I don't have? I'm never going to be challenged why I didn't support the whole issue. That's Kenneth. They have a lot of money, somebody's going to ask him one day. They once came to you, they told you the yeshiva or the shul is falling down. What did you answer? You gave them $2,000 and they said wonderful. And that's to be machna for you and thank you and say, good boy, good boy. What good boy? Where is the other $20,000? You have my son, where is it? It's your responsibility. That's what he says here. That's what he says. If you wonder in Radrega Amitis, what's called Melech Yid? In Radrega Amitis, a person would like that his Machshava and his lathe could be Panui Lavodas Hashem. He doesn't have his head scattered out with millions of different things. Yeah? And you should know, one of the qualities of the Dolim, big people is that they have the ability in their, even though they have millions of issues that are brought to them, not just financial issues, but millions of issues that clutter up their head, personal problems, business problems, and cloud problems, etc. Their tremendous strength is when they come to sit down to learn, they can divorce themselves from the whole thing. No pizza or mesh. Yeah, that's a radical. Now most people can't do that. If they have the problems, they're stuck. So they have not have the problems. But a real great person can have the problem, and the time is learning to go to suffer. That's a phenomenal strength in the Shah. I said that the Heilige Chasam Sofer is a Chol Lebrach, and the Chasam Sofer had a son who was dying at a certain point. And he said, when she was in the morning, he used to say, Tillim, Namish, tear the Himmel apart. And the Balabas once came to visit him, half an hour after Tillim, she was sitting down quietly writing. The Minim Chasam Nefesh. So I said, yeah, half an hour ago, you were literally Korea Shemayim Boretz. And now you're sitting in the Menucha. So he says, Ace Tillabalakir, Ace Limited. Shas Tvila is Tvila, the whole strength. So now, no, no, I'm going to give to let the Bush is up. The Bitter of Yibush, Malachi Maya. Right? But the regular person can't do that. The regular person has to know, you're entering into business, you're entering into wealth, fine. Number one, it comes with responsibilities, big responsibilities. Number two, it comes with Pizura Nefesh. Right? How many people down there, very wealthy people, who haven't got time to learn because they're maintaining their wealth? They would have been saying this, it's like a joke. Yeah, I mean, I've got so much money coming out of my nose. I know he's needed to do any work. But to keep everything going, I'm busy 24 hours and I'm wired sick. Right? Now, the old Amru, and another member of the Chachamim, Ezel Ashir, Hasanech Bechelko. That everyone knows in the bottom line that the real tranquility and the real substance in life comes from the ability to appreciate what you have, more or less. But if you can really be happy with what you have, people can make do be surprised on quite limited amounts. And nevertheless, they have the right set of priorities, they can kind of work at it, but you can make a go at it. And a person who has real betochen, he gets to the real purpose and function of his world. Kromar, who masik ayodah as parnasasa. Through the wealth, he takes his income. Ach mubli shetiyulot tudus ha-machshavish ha-balamon. But he divorces himself from the concerns of a regular wealthy person. There's dargosu ha-tmidus ha-mon, and the constant concern that a regular person has for money. Kroshavish ha-melech, misikush nasa-ovoid, umat v'mhaibo yochal v'asova la-oshu ha-mon v'niyach ha-lisha. Satisfaction doesn't let him sleep.
This is so true
in
not even heaven.
Actually, it's true. People, I've got a guy over here, one guy does a lot of buying selling houses. He wakes up 2 o'clock in the morning. Every morning he wakes up, worried. He said, can I carry the mortgage? Will I sell it? Well, how's it going? What, right? And he's got more money than he needs. He could retire now.
Right? Hasn't had a good night's sleep.
Probably hasn't had a good night's sleep with him. Never, but whatever he's going to do.
Yes, he takes a pill.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying, isn't it, it's what we say, Ipcha Mestada, the guy who has nothing and is struggling to eat, he sleeps at night, and he's a guy who's got enough money, he could retire, and he can't sleep at night, Dagat Mamon, which Dagat Mamon, that's the way the world is. So the only way you can thrash through this is either to tackle it in limited amount, or to work so hard on Mitata Pitachon, but you say, I devote so and so many hours a day to my parnasa. I refuse to devote more, and I don't feel you have to devote more, and that's what I'm going to do. And I don't think about it beyond that. And it's easier said than done, I understand. But that's what we're talking about aiming at. In order that the wealth shouldn't be the controlling factor or the concerns of knowing wealth, they just be business concerns, shouldn't be the dominant factor in a person's life, he has to be able to divorce himself. When he reaches that, I don't know if he can reach that level, I don't know. That's the challenge. If he reaches it one day in his life, since you don't. Yeah. Interesting challenge.
Very hard one.
Of course it's a hard one. But what the Chodos and Rebbes are doing here for you, what you have to know is, my friend, is he's analyzing it as a chisaron in the tachon. Let's know what area we're fighting in. He's suggesting it's a chesaron in betochen, it's a weakness in betochen, that which we cannot convince ourselves from our activities. We're not prepared to say, I make investing this amount and no more. We're prepared to say that. You get so involved in it, becomes, you know, you're trying to buy the property, and you're angry for every side, will you make it, the escrow, competition, etc. All that is a chesaron in betochen. You do what you have to do, and the rest then you put on the hold, you're fighting. And the truth about the line is that always remember what happens anyway. After all the effort you make, if you get it because the link is right. And if you don't get it, after all the effort, it's not as if you can control things. So you're feeling that you want to be hands-on. So that feeling is not a kosher feeling, and you're trying to reduce that. So you challenge.
Very hard one. You either are so wealthy that you couldn't care less.
That's not true either. The more wealthy you are, the more you care. It's not from very wealthy people say, like, I don't care. A wealthy person has devoted his life to wealth. Every deal is a success. Every deal, it's not a matter of how much money it makes. It's a matter of the skill and the power that I can manipulate and maneuver around the world of commerce and make it. I'm not going to be defeated. But I don't think we're wealthy.
It's not a matter of the money anymore.
That's right.
What difference did it make?
I mean,
you don't anyways know what you've got anyways. There's no way that you can know exactly what you're having.
There's no way that the people of Duke make any difference any individual deal.
It's up and down and this and that. That doesn't really happen. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge. That's their life's challenge. So he's telling you, look, it just has parameters. It has parameters. Okay. Let's go over here.